UN Secretary General and Turkey's President are in Kyiv.
The discussion of the steps to be taken to improve the functionality of the grain corridor, which is now working from Odessa port.
Plus, what was President Zelensky hearing from the United States before Russia started attacking?
The quote he had was, I felt like they were preparing us for a soft surrender. And the "they" there, he's referring to Russia, of course.
And later in the program, taking care of Ukraine's pet population. Today is Thursday, August 18th, 2022. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Reddish, in for Steve Miller. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres and Turkey's President Recep Erdogan met with President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv to talk about grain shipments, among other issues. Earlier, I spoke to our Anna Chernikova in Kyiv via Skype about the meetings and other developments in Ukraine today.
President Zelensky, firstly, we'll probably have discussion with President Erdogan, and this discussion, the agenda of this meeting reportedly will include the discussion of the steps to be taken to improve the functionality of the grain corridor, which is now working from Odessa ports, and resolve the war through diplomatic means. So this is what we know about possible topics for discussion. Among other issues, in the discussion between two presidents, it is planned to discuss Turkey's mediation in the exchange of prisoners between Russia and Ukraine, as well as the return to Turkey of two Turkish Air Force aircraft that were in Ukraine before the war and continue to be located in Ukraine. Also, we hear that it might be a meeting between the Minister of Defense of Ukraine and Turkey as well. In regards to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he will definitely also meet with President Zelensky, and the main topic for discussion will be the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, and also as well a possible political solution to end the war with Russia. So United Nations has said it may facilitate a visit by International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors to Zaporizhzhia from Kyiv, but Russia refused this offer. Mr. Guterres will try to find additional solutions. At least he will discuss this definitely in very big details with President Zelensky, because this issue of the Zaporizhzhia power plant is very, very important, and it's quite dangerous situation there at the moment. Also, we know that on Saturday, Mr. Guterres will visit the Joint Coordination Center in Istanbul, which is working on export of Ukrainian grain from the ports in Odessa through the Black Sea. So definitely this joint meeting that they will have, two presidents and UN Secretary General, will also definitely be a discussion of the grain deal.
So let's turn to the war and the tragic night in Kharkiv. Can you explain what happened and how deadly the attacks have been?
Yes, unfortunately, this last night was one of the most tragic for Kharkiv and the region in the entire war, during almost 6 months of war. For the moment, we know about 11 people dead and 37 injured. What actually happened is that last evening, around 11:30 in the evening local time, it was a shooting. It was a missile attack by Russian forces of the city of Kharkiv, of a couple of districts of the city, and a three-story residential building was hit. This building was a dormitory where people with hearing impairments lived. The house was almost completely destroyed, and it was a large-scale fire. And this caused a lot of casualties. For the moment, we know about 7 people dead and 20 injured. 4 people were rescued from under the rubble by the State Emergency Service of Ukraine. So while all this was happening during the night, because the tragedy happened very late in the evening, around 4:30 in the morning today, Russian forces launched another missile attack on the city of Kharkiv in particular and the region in general. We know about at least 8 missiles that were shot from the Belgorod, from the city of Belgorod in Russia. And again, these missiles hit at least 2 districts of the city of Kharkiv. Again, residential buildings were damaged and civilian infrastructure were damaged. For the moment, we know about 2 people dead and at least 18 injured, including 2 children. But the rescue operation is still ongoing and all special services are working on the ground. So final information on the numbers might come a bit later. I would just would like to mention that in recent days, the city of Kharkiv in particular has again been subjected to very intensifying shelling, and not only at night, but also during the day.
What can you tell us about concerns about a massive missile attack on Ukraine on its Independence Day, which is next week?
Well, we hear from Ukrainian military officials and from the intelligence that it might be a massive, there is a risk and a big scare of massive missile attack on the whole territory of Ukraine on the Independence Day. So Independence Day is next Wednesday, and what we hear from the Department of Strategic Communications of the Armed Forces of Ukraine is that Russia is concentrating a large number of transport launch containers with anti-aircraft guided missiles. These missiles are particularly for the C-300 air defense system, but not only for that system. Ukrainian officials say that Russia is bringing this different kind of missiles close to the border with Ukraine and also to the occupied territories. Currently, it was seen from the footages, from the satellite footages, that an echelon with missiles from Ulan-Ude is going to close to the border, and it is supposed to arrive around 20th of August. So Ukrainian officials are saying that there is a threat of a massive missile attack, and it might be that Independence Day will be one of the main days for this attack. Again, we will see. We will be controlling the situation, but this is the scare that Ukrainian military official is reporting for the moment.
That was our Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv. The Washington Post published an in-depth report about the run-up to Russia's attack on Ukraine that included perspectives from Washington and Kyiv. The Post correspondent in Kyiv, Isabel Kushudian, interviewed Zelensky for the report, and she shared her insights about Zelensky's view of the intelligence he was receiving and how he deciphered it with VOA's Russian service.
You know, in the interview, he struck me as really defiant, right? That he was really sticking to Ukraine's decision making, and that he felt like they did everything right, or at least they did the best they could. And so there wasn't really any apologies or regrets or we should have listened or anything like that. I mean, his point was, the U.S. did not give us specific information. Now, U.S. officials we've spoken to deny that. They say they did give pretty specific information and intelligence. And he also felt like had he, you know, really started to warn Ukrainians and taken some of this advice to evacuate himself to Western Ukraine or even to Poland or whatever, that it would have, you know, put Ukraine on weaker footing before Russia's invasion. And I did think the most surprising thing he said in the interview was that he felt like some officials in the West, and I don't think he was referring to necessarily Americans, he was pretty nonspecific, but that he felt like some officials, those offers to evacuate him or kind of those who were imploring him to warn Ukrainians, you know, were kind of expecting a Ukraine to, you know, fold very quickly and to be for Kyiv to be captured immediately. And then they would just be able to negotiate directly with Russia and strike a deal. And, you know, these prolonged sanctions that, let's be honest, are damaging for Europe's economy, you know, they wouldn't be quite this extensive and this bad. So he thinks, you know, the quote he had was, you know, I felt like they were preparing us for a soft surrender. And the they there, he's referring to Russia, of course, but he thinks that a lot of this campaign of information and, you know, kind of leaks that Russia was preparing to invade was intended to get Ukraine, to warn its people, to get people to flee, to create chaos in the economy, and to really make Ukraine easier to capture in that sense. I think his point is, you know, what a lot of Ukrainians believe too, which is that, okay, if you were so sure that, you know, the full-scale invasion was coming, then, you know, why didn't you give us proper weapons for this, right? Why were you telling us to... I had a quote from my conversation with his chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, that didn't make the story. But it was like, were we supposed to dig trenches on the border with Belarus to defend from the missiles that were flying from there? And that's a good point, right? Like, how are they supposed to prepare when the weapons they have are incredibly, you know, small arms, they're more for counterinsurgency. They're really for a resistance movement under occupation, javelins, things of that sort. And what they needed was better air defense systems, aircraft, you know, things of that sort, because it was a different kind of war than they'd ever fought in the East. So his point was the weapons they were giving us, it did, you know, point to a more conflict in the East because it was a lot of the same stuff that we had and we'd been dealing with. And if you're, you know, what is the point of all of your signals, all of these warnings, if you're not going to give us, you know, the proper weapons to defend ourselves? What are we supposed to do with all of that? Like destroy the economy, panic people, and make the country weaker before Russia invades? I mean, that would be his counter argument.
That was Washington Post Kyiv correspondent Isabel Krishudian. Russia's invasion has affected several aspects of life in Ukraine. Maxim Moskalkov reports about the effect the war has had on the adoption of children.
According to the U.S. State Department, in 2020, Americans adopted more than 200 children from Ukraine. Ryan Hanlon, CEO and president of the National Council for Adoption, says in that same year, Ukrainian children made up more than 10% of all kids adopted by Americans.
These were children that were older and often had lived many years in an orphanage setting before being matched with a family approved by Ukraine's government. The family would go to court in Ukraine, finalize the adoption, and then travel home after the U.S. government had also approved it. When the war broke out, of course, travel was halted.
According to a number of U.S. adoption agencies, when the war started, more than 200 families were at different stages of the adoption process. About 100 of those families ended up in adoption limbo.
Many of those children had already been hosted by U.S. families. Now those children, these families are pursuing an adoption. Those children might be in refugee camps. They're in settings that aren't, of course, ideal.
Phil and Christy Graves got lucky. They were supposed to learn on February 25th when they could take their adoptive daughter Bridget home. On February 24th, Russia invaded Ukraine. The Graves waited for 6 long weeks before finally picking Bridget up from Lviv.
There's a big part of you that wants to, like, push the Ukrainian government. Let me just come get my kid. Let me just come get my kid. But at the same time, there's... You know, you understand they're fighting for their freedom and their, you know, for their lives, and you don't want to bug them about adoption.
Gina Callahan and her husband agreed they would adopt 8-year-old Sveta back in 2019 after her second trip to the U.S. as part of the hosting program. But in 2020, COVID-19 made proceeding with adoption difficult. On February 22nd, 2022, the family finally got the green light.
The day we got our approval, we were so excited. It was so much work. And finally, we got the answer we were hoping for. But that same day, Russia started evacuating their embassy in Ukraine. And my husband and I looked at each other and we're like, this is not going in a good direction. Like, that's a really bad sign. So now we're in a waiting game.
Like many other prospective adoptive American parents who found themselves in a similar situation, Gina is encouraging the US and Ukrainian governments to allow families to host the children temporarily during the war and resume legal proceedings when the war ends. Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Reddish. Next week will mark 6 months from when Russia began attacking Ukraine. Anna Borshkaeva is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. She discussed the state of the war in Ukraine with VOA's Carol Castiel in this week's episode of Press Conference USA, including Russia's strategy of using the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant as a staging area for rocket and missile attacks.
Russia is determined to destroy Ukrainian sovereignty, to destroy the idea of Ukraine as a nation, as an idea. I suspect that the dreams of government change in Kiev are probably still fairly prominent in the ruling elite thinking. And the fact of the matter is, this is how Russia does warfare. It is brutal. And they often destroy territory to take it. They have this position right now. As you said, they've taken this power plant earlier, and they exploit any opportunity that they have.
Moving along, let's take a look at another, actually a setback for Russia. What is your assessment of the strike on Russia's Sakhy Air Base in southwestern Crimea, which suffered extensive fire damage, according to Reuters, with burned out husks of at least 8 destroyed warplanes? How much of a setback, in your view, is this for Russia's war strategy in Ukraine? Because it was trying to pivot from the Donbas in the east to attack southern Ukraine.
Well, it's a little bit too soon to tell. It's certainly significant, and that's why you see the Russian side downplaying its importance. The fact of the matter is, this is one tactical piece still of a bigger picture that is still unfolding. And from a big picture perspective, what we're now looking at is the Ukrainian counteroffensive in the south, as well as Russian gains in the Donbas region. They're fairly small if you kind of watch this from a day-to-day tactical movement perspective. But it's still happening. And really, the key question is, first and foremost, that the coming weeks are going to be very important in terms of what turn the war might take. The fact of the matter is, Ukrainians, and they admit this themselves, when they train militarily, they train for defensive operations, not for offensive operations. And if Ukrainians are able to capture Kherson, if they're able to actually have a successful counteroffensive in the strategic south. The south is very important because it has to do with access to the Black Sea, with strategic waterways, with Russia's trying to carve out a land corridor from Russia to Crimea. So if the Ukrainians are in fact successful at a critical time when cold weather is coming by approximately mid-September or so, it might put the Ukrainians in a better negotiating position in the future. But at this point, again, we're seeing smaller tactical pieces. The bigger picture will likely show itself in the weeks, if not months ahead. Military experts say that any war looks very different with the benefit of hindsight when you take a step back rather than when you look at it from a day-to-day operation.
That's certainly true. But one more question on this Sakhy Air Base and the strategy of Ukraine. What does this strike tell you about Ukraine's tactics and strategy to defend its sovereign territory from further Russian aggression and to recover parts of the east that Russia is controlling, and now even Crimea, which Moscow illegally annexed in 2014. President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that the liberation of Russian-occupied Crimea is now an official war aim.
First, what this says is that Ukrainians remain determined, that their morale remains high, and they are able to make tactical gains. So again, from a tactical perspective, this is important. And again, this is why the Russians are downplaying what happens. But again, it's a smaller piece in the bigger picture. In the bigger picture, really, the weeks ahead are going to be especially important for all the reasons that I've mentioned. Kherson region and the Zaporizhia regions are important because Russian forces had taken them early on in the invasion. and the location is what matters strategically. And together with southern Donetsk, especially, they form a land bridge connecting Russia to Crimea. And so if the Ukrainians are able to stop Russia from cutting Ukraine off from vital access to the Sea of Azov and to the Black Sea, what the Ukrainians are also trying to do here, what they've been successful tactically in recent weeks, is blowing up strategic bridges, again, to preventing Russians from moving in. The indicators on the ground were that the Russians were planning another false referendum in Kherson, very much like what they had done in Crimea. The date of September 11th was floated around, and now it seems like there's no specific date. So again, tactically, that's important. The ability to conduct these tactical operations does show certain strength on the Ukrainian parts. It's a smaller piece in a bigger picture.
Further to that, Anna Borshevskaya, how would you assess overall Ukraine's strategy and the political will of the leadership and the resilience of the Ukrainian people, notwithstanding Russia's disinformation campaign against them? What do you think their bottom line is? What, in your view, is Kyiv seeking as a goal?
You're asking two very important questions here, and one specifically is about the Ukrainian strategy. To the best of our knowledge that we can understand the Ukrainian strategy, it does go back to the point that I made earlier, and that is that on the one hand, there's no lack of willpower, no lack of determination. If anything, Russian atrocities like in Bucha that we've seen in other places, the tortures of Ukrainians that we've seen, the indiscriminate bombings, all of these actions, if anything, have strengthened the resolve of the Ukrainians. And the fact of the matter is, analytically, those of us who know Ukraine, I think, are not surprised, because Ukrainians have always resisted control. Ukraine is the one country in the post-Soviet space that has escaped Putin's grip and has gone as far as it has in terms of joining the West. And that is one of the key reasons why he's punishing Ukraine with this war. Having said that, again, on the flip side, going back to my point earlier, if there is a Ukrainian strategy, it is mostly defensive. And they also remain reliant on outside help, chiefly on weapons coming from the United States. Europe, by some accounts of military analysts, is almost tapped out when it comes to weaponry. A lot of European stockpiles will take years to replenish. So really, it's mostly on the United States to continue providing Ukraine with weaponry. It is mostly on the West to keep its unity, especially in the coming months ahead. Again, when the weather is going to get cold, when Russia is already threatened to cut off gas to Europe. So on the one hand, there's no shortage of resolve. And in fact, the Russian side was probably surprised early in the war, in the very early weeks of the war, to the extent that the Ukrainians were able to resist. But on the flip side, again, Ukraine remains dependent on Western assistance, and they keep asking for more weapons, and they will need more weapons. We're often too slow in providing them the weapons that they need. We often don't provide enough. And so the course of this war, certainly its end remains uncertain. But again, one way or the other, they're looking at long-term protracted warfare. And Russian aims for their part to destroy Ukrainian sovereignty in the long term have not changed, even if they take a tactical pause for months. The Ukrainian side, most recently, from what we heard, it seems, wants to go back to the pre-February 2014 borders. How likely that is, to some extent, again, will depend on the Ukrainian negotiating position. And that's why what will happen in Kherson might potentially, as analysts are suggesting, shift the dynamic of the war.
That's going to do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Reddish. Good night.
Washington, D.C.